Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report with me, John Iderola, and someone who will be revealed in just a few seconds. Really fast, I saw one of the comments immediately was, "Hey, John, almost on time today," and I thought, on one level, a professionalism level, I get it. I should have started 2 minutes ago, but on the other hand, where are you going? You can't go anywhere. You were just gonna be at home anyway. How's it going, Emma?
And you guys, here. I don't normally defend John, but he's literally producing, much production help from afar, but there's only so much people can do. He's doing it all on his own, so I really admire his fortitude.
Thank you. And obviously they're joking. I don't actually mind. But anyway, glad to have you here. And on a Tuesday of all things, glad to have
only you. Because I've rescheduled for the past like three times to Wednesday.
Exactly.
My Tuesdays are kind of packed. So
I thought your goal was to really destroy the cultural cachet that JR Wednesdays had built up over the years.
Since he was on Tuesdays. I want to dismantle every traditional element of your show.
Yeah, the continuing war on JR. I don't really get it. Why can't you guys make peace? But anyway, we're going to be talking about a lot today. We've got updates on what's happening with the National Guard. Spoiler alert, it's not good. We're going to be checking in with what medicine the president is taking. You don't know what story I'm talking about. It could be anything. You don't know. What else? Nancy Pelosi. Should we clap for her or denounce her? Updates on the Ahmaud Arbery case. We're going to take a little look internationally, what's going on outside of coronavirus. And then if we can get to it, one of the most dishonest graphics on Fox News that I can remember for a long time. We're going to close out the show with that. I did want to say one or two other things before we jump into the news. First of all, I saw that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had endorsed Nabila Islam in Georgia's 7th District Democratic primary. So that is awesome news. She's been on the show, you know, a whole bunch of times. Actually, there's a super chat coming in right now from James saying Nabila Islam has been endorsed by AOC. So, yeah, very exciting. Obviously pulling for her. Second of all, I only mention this because Emma's the guest co-host today. It is, I believe, to the day, 1 year since the last episode of Game of Thrones ran. So I just thought we should mention, not for any reason.
I've actually been rewatching season 3 and reading the first book, which is taking me forever. But yeah.
What do you think of the book?
I love the book. I mean, the first book is so, so similar to the first season, but you know, what stands out to me more is one, John is just so much better in the book. I think he's way more complex and intelligent than they portrayed him in the show. And I also think that's, I'm not going to blame Benioff and Weiss for once. I think Kit Harington like is probably the weakest actor out of the major cast members. And I think that stands out. He's really good at the stunts and stuff, which I think is cool. But like,
after that burn, he's going to need Melisandre's help.
Yeah. But in terms of portraying his like psychological torment about like, you know, being a bad, I think it's way richer in the books. And then just rewatching season 3, the quality was so much better than even when they went off book, like in season 5, that was when the decline happened. And then it ended in crashing and burning in the last season. But God, the first 4 seasons are just perfect. Perfect.
Yeah. I like those first 4 as well. And the others.
No.
I also want to mention this just as a reminder. I know that we're gonna talk about coronavirus, obviously, but so a way to visualize the magnitude of the tragedy. This was written, this tweet, I forget who said it, but it was when we were at 90,000 deaths. It's the equivalent of a full 737 crashing every day for 14 months. And it's like, you could watch all of Fox News today and they will not acknowledge that this is even a tragedy. And if it is, the only thing you should care about is being able to go back to Zumba and finding out where exactly in China it came from.
Yeah, blaming China. Because if there aren't literal human beings of different skin tones and ethnicities to blame, it's not a real tragedy if anyone dies.
100%. Yeah, it's an amazing line to walk where it's like, on the one hand, this is not a disaster. Don't get mad about it. On the other hand, it is such a disaster that we need to know how China's to blame. but they're managing to walk that. Anyway, I can see from the chat that Zane thinks we're taking too long to get into the story. So why don't we jump into it, Emma?
Okay. Let's do it.
Okay. Little slap in the face for National Guard members who have been helping deal with the pandemic across the country. More than 40,000 of them currently helping states test residents for the coronavirus and trace the spread of infections will face a hard stop on their deployments on June 24th. So we know ahead of time that they're going to be called back at that point. And the slap in the face isn't just that they're doing their duty. States are so thankful of all of the help that they provided, and they're going to be stopped from doing that long before their help is no longer needed. It's that a senior FEMA official acknowledged during a call that the June 24 deadline that we talked about means that thousands of members who first deployed in late March will find themselves with only 89 days of duty credit, one short of the 90-day threshold for qualifying for early retirement and education benefits under the post-9/11 GI Bill. Just a coincidence that they're going to be called back way premature, and one day premature of when they'd get extra benefits for all of the work they've done, potentially exposing themselves to coronavirus and helping those who have been.
Well, they could just pop hydroxychloroquine every day and they'd be fine. It's pretty much the same as the extra benefits they would get. I thought this was the pro-troop party. It blows my mind that whenever mainstream media talks about the Republican Party and that they're kind of being nationalistic and giving lip service to the troops, that they don't bring up the fact that, for example, when Bernie Sanders was the dealing with Veterans Affairs in the Senate and he was the head of that, it's escaping me right now, but
committee?
When he was the head of that committee in the Senate, he was going all in to give veterans more benefits, to ensure that more funding was provided for their health care, for resources for them when they return from war. John McCain was on the other side trying to slash many of those benefits. And they went back and forth and back and forth. And yet the Republicans are always portrayed as the pro-troop, pro-military party. Nothing is more pro-military than paying the military. And Donald Trump is trying not to pay the military.
Exactly. And that's what I really hope that this becomes a bigger story. It's like maybe third or fourth tier in the news today. It is so obviously indefensible. And not just like I'm seeing it and I think that it's indefensible. Their reaction to the news coming out shows that they think it's indefensible. So for instance, top National Guard and other federal officials that were on the call when it was announced didn't dispute that cutoff. They didn't raise the possibility of an extension. And since the news has been reported, the White House has not responded to multiple requests for comment for understandable reasons, because this looks really, really bad. And even on the call, that senior FEMA official said, "We would greatly benefit from unified messaging regarding the conclusion of their services prior to hitting the 90-day mark and the retirement benefit implications associated with it." So it's like, okay, this is going to be bad. Nobody's going to like it. Let's really get on message here about why we're doing this. And it's been a bit. There doesn't seem to be a message just yet. They think, I guess, they can keep their heads down and just weather this, and that's probably going to work, honestly.
And part of the kind the way that this may not, get enough traction that it should in the media is because people in the military and the National Guard, they're hamstrung from really speaking out publicly, and so it's almost extra cruel. Because Donald Trump and the Republicans can rob them of benefits that they've deserved and worked hard for and certainly put their lives at risk for, because basically he's the commander in chief and they're not allowed to speak out, at least, with their names publicly. And so they're able to kind of silently take away their benefits and under the cover of that kind of rulemaking. And so that's what makes it even kind of grosser to me.
Exactly. And also, so I'm primarily concerned about the fact that these people who have spent, you know, they will have spent 89 days effectively out there helping, that they like, a lot of them probably signed up, not necessarily for those exact benefits, but for the benefits that would come from service. The idea that you would string them along literally as long as possible before cutting them loose, right before those benefits, just sick, but also the consequence for the actual states. Governors and lawmakers in both parties have been pleading with the White House to extend the federal order for several more months or until the end of the year, warning in a letter to Trump that terminating those federal deployments early in the summer, just as states are reopening, quote, could contribute to a possible second wave of infection, because of course it could. We know that we need people doing the testing and doing the contact tracing as well. Federal government seems to have no interest in doing the raw hiring necessary to fill that. Now they're going to be taking away some of the people that are already in the field that could be doing that. Again, if you had if your going theory was the White House wants as many people to get coronavirus as possible, all of the news coming out day after day makes it harder and harder to fight against that obviously crazy belief. This is a great example of that. Now, the only sort of quasi-silver lining, one of the darkest silver linings I can imagine, is that while they will be one day short of those benefits, the National Guard, they have had a statement saying that the 90-day threshold is cumulative, meaning that if they are deployed again this year, then they could cross that threshold. And the thing is, because of how stupid and self-defeating this strategy is, they will almost certainly have to be deployed again later this year, because everything is being done, all the, you know, cards are being lined up for a devastating second wave when we will desperately need the help of these National Guard members again.
Well, you're assuming that there is any kind of, that ensuring that there isn't a second wave is a priority for the Trump administration. It's only the perception that things are getting better that they care about. Mm-hmm. And so when they get to get rid of the National Guard members from this kind of service and then also save some extra pennies in cash in terms of their benefits, as they're screwing the National Guard over, it's a bonus for them, because they want things to appear like they're better, because that's all Trump cares about. The whole presidency is marketing for him, and all of these government institutions, all of these agencies are arms of his marketing team. And we see that on a daily basis when it comes to his dealings with the coronavirus.
Yeah. And I think if it is just about controlling the perception, I mean, if people were reacting rationally to the number who have died, he would be terrified, I think, of a second wave.
But when do we have to be? When do we ever react, you know, when do people ever react rationally to death? I mean, we saw this with the Iraq War. If they don't see it in front of their eyes, it's really easy for governments to get away with atrocities.
Yeah, especially if the news is distracting them with, you know, Obama Gates and stuff like that, and not acknowledging the number dead. Like, I believe that I have been, I mean, I think if you watch this show day by day, I'm being destroyed by how terrible the news is recently. I think I try to take it very seriously. I try to continually bring it back to what is most at stake here. But even my amount of coverage probably isn't actually, like, it doesn't rise to the level of the, you know, one 737 crashing every single day. Fox News, like, if you were to just watch their coverage, the limited coverage that remains of coronavirus, because they've largely moved on, like, how many deaths would you say their outrage matches up with?
Like, I have people in my life who watch a lot of Fox News, older people, and they don't care. I mean, they just are, you hear Sean Hannity talk about reopen the economy, and then like 2 days later, you'll have a conversation with that person. They're like, we have to reopen the economy. I mean, it's just, it's truly like some sort of psychotic, like, or hypnosis or whatever. I mean, there's no when there's no focus on deaths, none. And when you just make it about big line must go up, there's a huge fraction major part of this country that just isn't thinking about that, and that has directly, that's the direct consequence of propaganda that's widespread. specifically on Fox News.
I want to see a red hat with big line must go up. That's the whole thing.
Make anyway. Big line up again.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Big news yesterday, Donald Trump is taking a potentially lethal medicine for a disease he doesn't have, or not. He wants you to believe it, though. Take a look.
And a lot of good things have come out about the hydroxy. A lot of good things have come out. And you'd be surprised at how many people are taking it, especially the frontline workers, before you catch it. The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine.
When?
Right now, yeah.
Yeah, when?
A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it. It's been around for 40 years for malaria, for lupus, for other things. I take it. Frontline workers take it. A lot of doctors take it. Excuse me. A lot of doctors take it. I take it. Now, I hope to not be able to take it soon because, you know, I hope they come up with some answer.
So, I don't know if he's lying because I would guess he has financial incentives to lie about hydroxychloroquine. There are ties with the manufacturer. But it's also just about the perception that there's something out there. They stockpiled up on all of this. They want other people to take it. And the idea that it's like, oh, it's like taking an Advil. It's for malaria. It could hurt your organs. And the VA study shows that it almost had adverse effects in their specific controlled study. Yeah, I know that it wasn't exactly perfect and it only tested men, ages, whatever. But yeah, I would not talk about, it's not a vitamin. It's not a vitamin, dude.
It's not Flintstones. It can and has killed people. Obviously, and that's why, like, his, like, what, and you know, it's not gonna hurt me, yeah, but you idiot, you know that it can hurt people, you know that it has side effects, potentially fatal, it has mental health side effects, it has side effects on your heart, you know that. Okay, we're gonna move past it, because there's no point. You know, it's been prescribed for other things. Okay, I have sinus headaches, I'm gonna take chemo. They do chemo for other things, why not take it for my sinus headaches? What's the worst that's gonna happen? It's not gonna hurt me. It's just, it's so stupid and probably a lie. That's the stupidest part of it. So really fast, I want to jump to the chat. We're going to continue, but there are like probably three options we'll say here. So I want you to type a short message, either taking it if you think he's taking it, lying if you think that he's just lying, and placebo if you think he thinks he's taking it, but he's not actually taking it. So let's just see it. Either taking it, lion, or placebo. That's my guess, but we're gonna push forward really fast. I want to show you another video because this is really something. Take a look at this.
I would have told you that 3-4 days ago, but we never had a chance because you never asked me the question.
Yeah.
You never ask about my health. You're always asking about the health of the country, the deaths. And yeah. Of course, you don't want to know about me.
Mm-hmm.
Selfish reporters, self-obsessed.
It's a good point. They didn't spontaneously decide to ask if you were taking a potentially lethal medicine that doesn't work on a disease that you don't have. Yeah, they hadn't asked you about that for whatever reason.
It's a disgruntled wife who they didn't even notice he got his hair cut.
Exactly. So I'm seeing the response, and I'm gonna guess it is 98 out of 100 lying, one placebo, and one somebody just put a whole bunch of lying emojis. So yeah, most people think that he's lying. Yeah, he just made it up, man, and he probably made it up right then. As he didn't know when he started the sentence where he revealed he was taking hydroxychloroquine, he didn't know he was going to reveal that he was taking it, or say that he was taking it. It's just so stupid. And like we said with the quiz, I don't know exactly how it's stupid. Is it that he's actually taking it, that he's taking for preventive use a thing that he has seen is probably not effective in dealing with this and could by itself kill him, that he would lie about it and again inspire his followers to take this and potentially die as a result of it? I don't know, and I don't care. I'm going to say something that is going to become a larger and larger percentage of my total speech as we move forward over the next 6 months. My conclusion is vote him the hell out of office so that we don't have to deal with this BS anymore. How about that?
That's a good conclusion for every Trump story.
Yeah, unfortunately. Okay, so really fast. I just want to let him dig himself a little bit deeper. So let's see if his doctor's involved in this.
Did the White House doctor recommend that you take that? Is that why you're taking it?
Yeah, White House doctor. Didn't recommend. No, I asked him, what do you think? He said, well, if you'd like it. I said, yeah, I'd like it. I'd like to take it. A lot of people are taking it. A lot of frontline workers are taking hydroxychloroquine. A lot of front... I don't take it because... Hey, people said, oh, maybe he owns the company. No, I don't own the company. You know what? I want the people of this nation to feel good. I don't want them being sick.
That's how I know he's lying. The doctor, he didn't say, do you want to take it? Go ahead. Do you want to take it? Yeah, you're fine. Yeah, that's all good.
I just want the world. I just want people to feel good. I just want them to feel good. Yeah. Well, again.
Everyone should be on heroin then.
Exactly. And that has a demonstrated effect. Okay, so he mentioned there that the doctor got involved. And this is where, like, the most exciting thing about working in the Trump White House is you wake up every day not knowing what lie you're going to have to tell. And the lie today was that he is taking hydroxychloroquine. So they put out a letter for what passes for a doctor in the White House these days. And people noticed something pretty quickly about the letter. I'm going to show you just a little bit of it. Saying after numerous discussions, he and I, this is the doctor, and Trump, had regarding the evidence for and against the use of hydroxychloroquine, we concluded the potential benefit from treatment outweighed the relative risks. In consultation with our interagency partners and subject matter experts around the country, I continue to monitor the myriad studies investigating potential COVID-19 therapies, and I anticipate employing the same shared medical decision-making based on the evidence at hand in the future, which is very interesting. And nowhere in that letter does it say that he told Trump to take it, or that he prescribed it for Trump, or that Trump is actually taking it. It's nowhere in the letter. And that's their evidence.
He's lying. I'm done. He's lying.
He's definitely lying. I like the idea, because he said he takes a pill every day. I liked the idea that he was having one Reese's Pieces each day thinking he was taking hydroxychloroquine. But that's probably not what it is.
That's just what he seasons his steak with.
Yeah. Look, you do have to give it to Trump, though. He is convinced that this thing is helpful, and he's not going to let, you know, evidence convince him otherwise. It is a sign of strength to go with your gut. And I would say to Trump that the doctors who tried to deceive you about this medicine and tell you that it's not helpful, you saw through those lies. They also will tell you that you're supposed to take a certain amount. But if a certain amount is good for you, then two times as much is definitely better, right? 10 times as much.
Well, even better. As he knows, there's only a finite amount of energy in the body, mm-hmm. and there's only a finite amount of hydroxychloroquine that the body naturally produces. So exactly. you're going to be more beneficial on the long run if you take a ton.
Exactly. And look, yes, I feel perfectly comfortable making that sort of joke because neither Emma nor I believe that he has or has ever actually taken any hydroxychloroquine.
Yes, we don't want Trump to die.
Yes. Not long after Donald Trump revealed that he was totally actually taking hydroxychloroquine, Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked what she thought about it, and here is what she had to say to Anderson Cooper.
As far as the president is concerned, he's our president, and I would rather he not be taking something that has not been approved by the scientist, especially in his age group and in his, shall we say, weight group, what is morbidly obese, they say. So I think it's not a good idea.
I liked it. I am so critical of Nancy Pelosi, but come on, like, first of all, what I liked more, and I don't like it as an electoral strategy. I think it's stupid. It only appeals to the hard, true blue core, whatever. Mm-hmm. Democrats, I get it. It's an offhand comment. It doesn't matter. But it's also
really fast. It's an offhand comment.
Okay.
You don't think she planned that?
No, she did. She had like a 15-second awkward lead up to it. I totally know that she planned it in advance. But I also don't understand why the left should be like upset that she does this. Trump makes fun of people's physical appearance on a daily basis. There can be one tiny comment about how he's fat because I know it bothers him.
Yes. Okay. So I want to try to address a few parts of that as we go back and forth on this. I mean, so I posted about how it seemed needless and all that stuff because I am dead set on making sure that as few people like me as possible. So when I see them being happy, I try to tamp it down. So Trump is going to attack people no matter what. He's going to do it viciously. What I worry about is, I want you to take a look at this tweet. So this is a tweet from Ben Shapiro, said, "Nobody is happier than Trump today that Pelosi called him morbidly obese. Now we can just riff freely on her overuse of Botox without fear of blowback." Which, look, yes. Is that a stupid tweet? Yes. Like, Trump has ever been worried about blowback for attacking someone's appearance. Ben Shapiro, you moron. But they will say that, and lots of them are saying that. The thing is, Donald Trump will attack people in the most vicious ways possible. Within the next 24 hours, he's going to accuse Nancy Pelosi on Twitter of drinking the blood of infants. He will do that. That is baked into the horrible situation we're in. What I am hoping for is that we will get to the end of Trump without it becoming thoroughly normalized that everyone should be that bad. It's probably a vain hope, but that is a hope that I cling to.
The thing, though, is that most Americans do see politics as a sport, and so why Trump has been successful is because he's a WWE caricature, and he'll name people and, like, mock them publicly. I do think that there is some benefit to not being so buttoned up and being able to sling mud and kind of go back and forth at each other. I mean, I know that the cruelty is horrible, but these are powerful people, and I don't really care if they're trading barbs on CNN.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thing I don't necessarily get is how is this very different? Like, in terms of the fat shaming, it's different, but how is this that different than, like, the clapping or the ripping up the speech? If we're going to criticize Nancy Pelosi for her performative stuff, that this is what that is.
Well, the ripping of the speech I despised. It was just dumbest. I was about to swear. Dumbest stuff I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But
isn't that what this is? I don't respect you. I hate you. You're stupid.
There's something different about that because that seemed more performative than what this is, mm-hmm. and also because Trump. You know, he's known for his insults, so he can take an insult back, specifically an insult about his appearance, which he does all the time. I mean, sometimes I enjoy it. When he like crouch down behind the podium to make fun of Mike Bloomberg being short. Are we going to pretend that that wasn't great?
I don't remember that. I can't even think of a time when Mike Bloomberg was in the race. That's the before times, before the fall of man.
And that was great. I mean, he did it all the time in Little Marco. Like, this is his game. And the ripping up of the paper, I think, is adjacent to that.
Yeah. Look, I think that you can be strong and aggressive. Like, I want Biden to be stronger and more aggressive. Him rolling out his nickname for Trump, which is President Tweety, just, I don't like it. I don't like
that
it.
That sucks.
But
that sucks.
I don't want him to, like, I don't want Biden to tweet a photo of Trump photoshopped onto Predator and it says Trump's a pedophile. Like, that's the direction that we're headed in as a society. That's
all
it is. I
disagree. It's different. This is, okay, it's just an off, I know that it's, she planned it, but in theory, it's an offhand comment on a cable news show. I don't think we should be developing strategy around it as Democrats, but I do think you can make a sly, mocking comment here and there to a president who has no problem dishing it out a little bit.
Well, look, I get that I'm wrong and everyone disagrees with me.
Is that what the chat says?
It's not super clear. They're pretty nice. But I know Cenk tweeted, like, sort of not 100% in favor of Nancy Pelosi, but kind of in favor, and I do
of
disagree.
Of course Cenk would be in favor of
yes.
this.
Now, here's the thing. Okay, so let's say I were to come over to your side and say it was an offhand thing. It wasn't part of a continue. It's not like tomorrow she's going to do an interview with Don Lemon and talk about his man boobs or something. Let's say it just ends right here.
Right.
Here's the issue, is that once she puts it out there, it produces things like this, which I screenshotted earlier today, which was, that's one screenshot, three trending hashtags, hashtag President Plump, hashtag Plump Trump, hashtag Girther Movement.
Yeah, that's the worst of this stupid resistance.
Yes. And the thing is, I saw a tweet yesterday. I forget exactly who it was from. I retweeted it. I probably should have remembered it better. But the tweet was just, I think it was, y'all know the fat people you like use Twitter too. And it's like, yeah, that's the thing. Oh, and I know it's not popular, and I'm not cool, and I'm not edgy to want to.
It's not edgy to support Nancy Pelosi. I don't like the fact that
I'm not talking about
laughed.
Okay, I mean specifically the desire to troll him back in the way that he trolls.
No, John, your instinct is correct on the macro level because the resistance sucks at trolling and they can't do it. Mm-hmm. So, like, the only way to beat the ultimate troll is with policy and with substance and with a grassroots movement that trumps his trash talking and false populism, but genuine grassroots movement with real people behind him who are eager and excited to vote for him.
Yeah.
The enthusiasm gap between Biden, people who are going to vote for Biden, people who are going to vote for Trump is still large, is massive, even more so than with Hillary Clinton, who people, independents and Republicans largely despise, but she had genuine enthusiasm with within the Democratic Party. Biden doesn't even have that. So, like, the trolling, it's why it even seems more egregious and empty is because the Democrats have no leg to stand on and are in a pathetic, scarily weak position. You control when you're on top. The Democrats are at the bottom right now.
Clip that out. Yes, I do agree with the point, though. Yeah, and look, I understand that there are some people that you just, he's hurt us in a variety of ways, policy ways, but also the, you know, shredding our sanity ways, and you want to hit him back. I get that. I would just say if you want him to hurt, think about the day he has to walk out of the White House. First of all, he probably won't. They'll probably cancel the election and all that stuff. But Matt, if it does happen, that is what will make him hurt. Sort of really sick update to the Ahmaud Arbery case. We have a few updates, but the first I want to talk about is the fact that the sister, Lindsay McMichael, the sister of two of the individuals involved in that brutal murder, apparently took a photo of Arbery's body and posted it on Snapchat, a decision that a lot of people had a problem with. And when she was reached out to find out why she had decided to do this, this is what she had to say. I had no nefarious or malicious intent when I posted that picture. The thing is, I'm a huge fan of true crime. I listen to 4 or 5 podcasts a week. I'm constantly watching that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, my favorite murder just turns you into a sociopath, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's a true crime podcast, John.
Yeah, is it?
I don't know. My best friend loves them. And yeah. She also is a sociopath.
Really? Oh, no. So I get
just
that,
like this woman.
Yeah, a lot of people really into the true crime. I get it.
It's one of the most pathetic excuses. She should be. They should test that whole family for like psychopathy and sociopathy. I mean, that is an unbelievable defense. You could say that you wanted to document the death. You wanted to show that perhaps, you know, I don't know, that you wanted photo evidence or something like that. But to say that it was some sort of sick fascination that you had because of true crime podcasts and TV shows.
Yeah.
That means that you are looking at that human being as removed as you would be if you're listening to a podcast or hearing about a murder. No, that person's in front of you, dead, because of your brother.
Yeah, and yeah, your family wasn't... It's just such... It's like, think... Go through a couple drafts and then speak. She goes on to say, it was more of a holy S, I can't believe this has happened. It was absolutely poor judgment. So she at least does acknowledge that it was poor judgment to do this. I mean, there is a... In these sorts of cases, there's always a PR battle about the credibility and motives and past of the people on both sides. There have to be, because in a case like this, where yet again white individuals have brutally murdered a non-white individual, there is always going to be Fox and the right is going to try to dig into the victim's past and try to present them as having... They basically want to come up with an excuse for their viewers to think that this person deserved to die. And they believe in a few different ways that they found that. So at first, it was that he had visited a construction site, and so he deserved to be killed. Then there's a video from 2017 where cops found him sitting in a park by himself and tried to tase him. That is going around because people, again, they're desperate to want to believe that he deserved to die. So that's happening. And so on the other side, I would imagine that if you are one of the two murderers in this case, you'd probably prefer if another member of your family hadn't seemed to make a joke or a spectacle out of the death of Ahmaud Arbery. I would probably expect that's what you'd want.
Might be beneficial for their defense, but it seems like complete callousness runs in the family and evil. Yeah,
exactly. Now, we do have a statement as well from Esley Merritt, attorney for the Arbery family, who said, "The picture Lindsay McMichael posted was very disturbing and very disturbing to the family. It actually fits the pattern of the McMichael family engaging in a weird, violent form of voyeurism." And by the way, I don't remember if we knew this when last we talked about this case, but apparently Arbery had been chased for 4 minutes by these individuals who, again, for 4 minutes chased him and decided rather than calling the police, which would already be insane, they decided to do what they did. And the family, by the way, is now calling for the third individual, the one who was in the back car and was filming it, to be arrested as well, because as they point out, he was participating in the chase. He helped in some ways to box in Arbery from being able to flee from these gun-wielding maniacs. And so we don't know if that's going to happen. He has apparently taken a lie detector test about some elements of the case, but that's what we know at this point anyway.
You know, it kind of undercuts your argument that Arbery might be dangerous if you are slowly following him in a car when he has none and has nothing on him for several minutes before murdering him in cold blood. So I don't even think manslaughter. I don't even think, and this is premeditated murder.
Yeah.
Premeditated murder, because they had all of that time to maybe rethink after they were stalking him that they didn't need to shoot him down and murder him in the street. They could have thought about that. They could have called the police. They could have done whatever they wanted to. They could have taken any other action based on their racist implications and racist thought patterns. No, but they decided to murder him anyway. So I think that threshold counts for premeditated murder, and I hope they get locked up for a really long time.
I don't know. I feel like this pit of dread in my stomach that, like, even with how brutal the video is, how much it reveals, that in the end is just going to be another case where nothing.
And that's how black and brown Americans feel every single day when they have to have their dealings with the police. They don't ever expect justice, and why would they?
There is a potential disaster brewing in the Bay of Bengal right now. To just add on top of the continuing coronavirus epidemic the countries in the region are dealing with, let's talk about Super Cyclone Amphan. It became the strongest storm ever recorded in the Bay on Monday night, after intensifying with sustained wind speeds of up to 270 kilometers per hour. It is just the second super cyclone to hit the Bay of Bengal since records began. During the last, back in 1999, nearly 15,000 villages were affected and almost 10,000 people were killed. And you can see here sort of an expected track of its progress throughout Wednesday and Thursday. And look, this is obviously purely on its own merits, potentially a disaster. Like we said, the last one killed 10,000 people. By the way, from that graphic, I believe that you can see Kolkata in the path of it. Yeah, there are lots of people living there. And so potentially a disaster for that reason. But also, we are, of course, still in the middle of a pandemic. And that means that mass movements of people, mass sheltering of people, once they've been moved out of the way of this storm, is going to, you know, bring its own potential dangers as well. And so, you know, I feel horrible for the people. Like, they're saying up to 300,000 people in the coastal areas of West Bengal and Odisha are in immediate danger from the storm and need to be moved. And already, they're already under the gun from coronavirus. And, like, they have cyclone shelters, 12,000 of them, but you have to social distance. And so, theoretically, it's going to be much harder. You're going to have to move people farther. It's going to affect more of the region. And this is, at the very least, for people in the U.S., a reminder that it's not like the other threats that we face have suddenly gone away. It's very easy to callously throw off a, hey, more people die from car accidents and the regular flu than coronavirus, which isn't even true. But even if it were, those deaths are still happening, too. And so this is a reminder that we have other disasters that are creeping up on top of the one that we're currently still struggling with.
And another reminder that science needs to be listened to. Yeah. We're seeing the intensity of these storms just, you know, multiply and multiply. And that has to do directly with oceans warming, climate change, science being disregarded because it doesn't oppose it doesn't pose an immediate threat that's right in front of your face. Mm-hmm. You know, the cyclone isn't about to hit these Republicans or conservatives or whatever right in the face, so they don't want to act now. But as we've seen in this pandemic, as we've seen in the discussion of climate change for decades now, we need to take proactive action, not reactive action, when it comes to handling natural disasters and pandemics or diseases like this. And people in coastal areas like this, in highly densely populated areas, like in this part of India, they're going to be hit the hardest. And the poorer you are, the less resources you have, you're going to reap these deadly consequences more acutely than the people who are making the decisions at the top, the callous, reckless decisions at the top.
100%. And yeah, I wonder, you know, hopefully they'll be able to get people out of the way, the weather fine, do testing and stuff like that. But if it is bad, any sort of disaster like this internationally right now is going to face significant, much more significant hurdles in terms of international aid, lack of resources and lack of bandwidth to deal with the issues of other countries. That's certainly a fear that I have. And here domestically, you know, right now, they're facing this super cyclone. Hurricane season in the U.S. For much of the East Coast starts in June. And we've been hit by both devastating hurricanes and devastating wildfires, the different coasts, over the past couple of years. When those hit, like, what's going to end up happening when you're having people packed in to limited areas. Or theoretically, you have people, say, in Florida, a state that's reopening, trying to get back to normal as much as possible. If those people have to flee to other parts of the state or to other states in the region to get away from a number of hurricanes, as has happened, I have family in Florida that has had to flee to Georgia multiple times. And Georgia itself is having issues. All of this compounds itself. And so I don't have any solutions, but I want people to bear in mind that these things act on each other. And I am very worried that, as Emma said, that people aren't going to listen to the experts in either end of this, the pandemic side or, you know, the natural disaster and the links to climate change. I want to show you a still shot from an episode of Sean Hannity's program, I believe from last night. And it's a chart that he's showing. And it's not one of the charts where he accidentally makes the case for, like, all the policies that AOC is pushing for. Those are always fun. No, this one, he manages to pack so much dishonesty into one graphic that it almost seems impossible. Take a look at this. So this is a comparison of California, Florida, I believe it's supposed to be Michigan, New York, and Texas, on a number of different metrics, including their population, their state income tax, for some reason. Not sure what that has to do with COVID-19 cases and deaths, which he logs next, and then the mortality rate there. And he seems to be trying to make the case that states that have opened up have fewer deaths, I think. But there's a few significant problems there. The first that I think we should mention is that he has a listing for mortality rate there. And you would think that means he's showing how deadly the disease is. So for the people who get it, what percent die? But that's not what those numbers show at all. Do you know what those numbers are? He is literally listing the percentage of the entire state population that has died from the disease at this point.
Because
if you look at the numbers, so for instance, for Michigan, he's got 52,000 cases, 4,900 deaths. That indicates that, I don't have a calculator with me, but slightly less than 10% of the people who got it died from it. And the last thing that Sean Hannity wants to do is list a 10% fatality rate. So instead, he just lists everybody in Michigan, what percentage has died at this point. It is so fundamentally unethical what he is doing right there.
Whew. Yeah, and I just wonder, producers, like, you guys want to get jobs elsewhere, right? I mean, I know that it's hard to get jobs in media and Fox News. You got to sell your soul a little to move up and do all that stuff. But do you really feel good about yourself when you are listing entire statewide mortality rates in order to make it seem like fewer and fewer people are dying? Mm-hmm. To underplay a threat that could really harm Sean Hannity's core demo of old people. I mean, it's not like it's spring chickens watching his show. So I think that it's unethical is, you know, underplaying it.
100%. I don't know. Like, I'll put it up a little bit. What does the income tax have to do with any of that?
No, it did.
It's not.
You'll have more money and you won't die.
It's like my immune system was weakened by the higher state taxes I was paying. And of course, let's say he just decided, I want to have stuff about coronavirus, but I also want to make a point about taxes. Also, maybe mention that in most of those states, the Republican states that have effectively no income tax, they tend to have a significantly higher sales tax. And the reason they do that is because they do still need money to run the state government, but they don't want an income tax because an income tax would hit people who make a lot of money. They want a sales tax, which isn't obviously one of the most regressive taxes imaginable. So he hides that from his audience as well, that they are still being taxed, but taxed in a way that hurts the poor more than the rich.
Exactly. And also, the mortality rate figures he shows there, they're not even, you know, different enough to actually prove the misleading point that he's trying to make. Like, New York isn't that significantly higher than Texas or Florida, and California isn't either. So I don't even understand what that adds beyond just being underplaying the mortality rate of the coronavirus.
Exactly. Yeah, and I wish that I could have any hope that the people watching his program last night looked at that and thought, oh my God, is that like 8% of New York cases that got it died? That's terrifying. No, they're just distracted by 0.146%. Oh my God, that's not too bad. Okay, well then, right. make a graphic of the percentage of the Texas population that has died from Islamic terrorism over the past couple of years. How high of a percentage is that? So we shouldn't do anything about it, presumably. What's their inheritance tax there? That's what I want to know. How are we supposed to fight against this? People who have so little regard for what their own devoted viewers actually think about the world, and not just lying to them about the state, the sales tax or whatever, but sending them out there ill-equipped to not get sick and die. There was polls recently showing that like older voters are apparently turning away from Trump and towards Biden, and I don't know why exactly that is. But if there is a reason, if there is an explanation for that, I hope it is that they realize that Fox doesn't care if they live or die. Like if that doesn't drive your political behavior, I don't know what should. Like lack of regard for whether you die. Very excited to be welcoming to the show, at long last, award-winning co-organizer of the 2017 Women's March and author of We Are Not Here to Be Bystanders, Linda Sarsour. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, John.
Glad to have you here. And I want to start by talking about the book. You know, I've seen some of your interviews about it and all of that, but it's a pretty fascinating look back at, you know, sort of where you came from, how you got to where you're at. Can you tell people a little bit about sort of the process of writing it, how you decided to, you know, look back over this time and all of that?
So this is my book. this book really, John, for me, was an opportunity to really welcome folks into the lives of Muslim Americans in the post 9/11 era. There's a lot of talk about Donald Trump and talking about policies of Donald Trump and talking about this fascist administration and the stripping of civil liberties. And Muslim Americans, as well as many other marginalized communities, are sitting back being like, welcome to our world. And I thought it would be important in this time to take people on the journey of the impacts of these policies, these post 9/11 policies on Muslims. It was also a love letter to my own family, to my children, you know, to my great, great grandchildren. You know, this is a story of being a survivor of intolerance, religious intolerance, of Islamophobia. I've been, at the receiving end of it, and I've been able to persevere and keep moving forward. And I thought this would be an inspiring and motivational book for my own communities.
Yeah, and you know, so obviously you talk about the experience you've had as an individual with that sort of discrimination, all of that. But in your work as well, you are the target of, I can only imagine, constant attacks and attempts to define who you are, to define what you believe, to define what you mean when you say certain things. Did you see this book as an attempt to sort of to take that back, to define yourself in a way against all of these very dishonest attacks that continue?
Absolutely. I mean, my book is stories and stories of my work, of my relationships, of my long track record of civil rights work, of human rights work, of focusing on racial justice and immigrant rights and economic justice, of defending my people, and also about what it means to be an unapologetic woman of color, a Palestinian Muslim. You know, John, I'm every Islamophobe's worst nightmare. And it's because of all the identities that I hold. I'm a Muslim. I'm also Palestinian. I'm an anti-Zionist. I'm also a progressive. So I kind of confuse people. How could I be a Muslim and wearing a hijab and be progressive in my policies and stand up for marginalized people? How could I be a Muslim woman that is loud and proud and unafraid, whose voice is loud? And so I'm shattering stereotypes as I go. And some people don't like that. And so, as you know, and as you've seen, attempt after attempt after attempt, and here I am, I'm talking to you about my book that was published by Simon & Schuster, one of the largest publishing companies in the world.
Yeah, and of course, congratulations on that. I want to talk a little bit about your work. You've talked about organizing and all of that, and how you sort of were, like a lot of people, coming to in the wake of 9/11, which obviously, you know, depending on what community you're in, has a very different effect on you. Some people were able to sort of sit on the sidelines and look at it. Other people more directly affected by it. What do you think about the nearly 20 years now since then. How much progress has been made, if any, in what areas? What concerns? Like I think about the fact that there are reauthorizations of portions of the Patriot Act that happened like within the last week. That, you know, it feels like it's been decades now, and yet a lot of that seems like the government is just sort of sliding along, believing that it's perfectly fine to continue in the exact same way.
And this is the important, uncomfortable conversation, John, that nobody wants to have. These types of policies that have been put in place in the name of national security that target Muslim Americans and others have been done by both Republicans and Democrats. There's like bipartisan support for the Patriot Act. And we know that from the many folks that have ran to be the president of the United States of America who voted for this policy. And there's been a reauthorization just a few days ago that said, you know, that the FBI could go into your browsing history and use it against you in a court of law without a warrant. I mean, this is the type of life that we live. In the last 20 years, we went from a suspected terror watch list that had about 3,000 people on it to potentially over close to 2 million people on it, majority of whom are people that hold Arab last name, Muslim last names. And we're talking about no-fly lists. We're talking about unwarranted surveillance of communities. You've watched the fights and the lawsuits of these mosque opposition groups that are going up against communities, my communities, who are trying to build local Islamic centers and mosques across the country. So it hasn't gotten better. In fact, we could argue that it's gotten worse. I mean, Donald Trump won a whole entire election on the backs of hating Muslims, on the backs of saying Islam hates us, on this idea that we're in war with Islam, as if Islam is a person. And so, unfortunately, we have continued to see year after year the Muslim registry program. People were like, I'll register as a Muslim, you know, after they heard Donald Trump and some Republicans during the 2016 election say that. But the Muslim community is like, where were you in 2003? There was a Muslim registry program. And so even when you hear people talking about abolish ICE, people don't understand that ICE was started in 2003. It was in response to the horrific attacks of 9/11, first focused on keeping out the quote Muslim terrorist. And then when they didn't find any Muslim terrorists after the horrific attacks of 9/11, they went and pivoted and started targeting, you know, asylees and mostly Central Americans at the southern border. And so, and terrorizing communities and raiding meat plants and raiding factories. And so we have to understand that this is reeling from the horrific attacks of 9/11, where communities continue to be directly impacted.
You know, so you mentioned it's a great line where you say that you're, you know, the worst fear of these Islamophobes. I absolutely love it. And, you know, the fact that you withstand such a constant barrage of these attacks and don't back down, I've watched that for a long time and found it to be very inspiring. So thank you for your continued work. I wonder, through the course of your experience, I mean, you mentioned that you got the book published by massive publisher. I remember in the initial years of the Iraq War, you know, not just on Fox, but on all the networks, anyone who spoke out against the war, even for caution in the war, was risking their entire career. The people who were brought on to talk about these issues were generally people that had either a vested interest in the war or were 100% supportive of it. Do you feel that there is more of an ability for people with perspectives like yours to be brought on, to be heard, to be respected? Has there been any sort of progress in that?
I think for me, I think I have pierced the mainstream in a way that a lot of folks in my community have attempted to in a really long time. Of course, I'm going to always be semi-marginalized just because I do share views that people want to suppress, you know, anti-war views, vehement critiques of, you know, the state of Israel, of, you know, countries like Saudi Arabia and others. You know, people don't like truth tellers. And we know this from the history of this country, John. So I'm not like naive to think it's only me and I'm somehow some anomaly. This is just historic and how it's happened. But I have built deep relationships in the progressive movement amongst white progressives, amongst progressive Jews, amongst Black communities, Latino communities, immigrant communities, Asian American, Pacific Islanders. And I'm very, very, very well respected within my own community. And one of the reasons I garner this respect is because I don't back down. I'm not going to change my convictions. I'm not going to be a neoliberal just to further my career. I'm going to be who I am. And I'm going to say the truth. If I hear or feel like there's going to be a war against Iran, I'm going to be the loudest voice on that. Just like, you know, in 2003, around the Iraq war, you know, I was young, but I was out there because I understand the impacts of war. I understand the impacts of military occupations. And I understand understand that we in the United States of America deserve to keep our resources here for the most marginalized and not spending trillions of dollars on unnecessary and unjust wars. And again, this is a nonpartisan relationship. You know, it's for me, what's really unique is that I'm targeted by anywhere from all the way to the right, all the way to the center, all the way to, you know, center left, because once you people feel like you cross the line and you're piercing the minds of people in a way that is transformative, there are going to be people who are going to try to stop you from that. And so far, you know, I feel pretty privileged and I feel pretty grateful that I have been able to change conversations and be part of the changing of narrative around Palestine and having more progressives feel, you know, confident to stand up and defend the rights of Palestinians, you know, to stand up more boldly on criminal justice reform, on immigration, on standing up against the war with Iran. I'm proud of that work and I'm going to keep doing it.
I want to look ahead a little bit because in addition to being an author and activist, you also were a surrogate for Bernie Sanders in the election. And, you know, for a lot of us, the election did not turn out the way that we were really, really hoping that it would. And so there's been this period amidst the pandemic of also trying to figure out what the path forward, what that looks like. So I'm curious, from your point of view, as someone who's been involved in it as an activist and an organizer, where should we be throwing our weight? Where can, you know, progressives or people who are concerned about these different issues, where can they have the most effect when, you know, they look to the two different choices, they don't necessarily love either of them?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those people. I was a surrogate for Bernie Sanders, and I was very proud to be part of a campaign that aligned with my principles and values, even when I didn't sometimes even agree with Bernie on some things. As you know, we don't agree on the issue of Palestine-Israel, but he overall, his policy platform, his domestic policy platform really spoke to me in the work that I've done for 20 years. I'm telling people right now, especially those of you who supported Bernie, who are true progressives, who are true at heart leftists and people who care about marginalized people, start focusing on down ballot races. John, every 4 years, we want to wake up and start talking about who's going to be the president. And I'm telling people, like, we got to do the work in between. I want to know which progressive you're supporting that is supporting the Green New Deal, that's supporting the abolition of ICE, that's supporting, a platform that is about just foreign policy, that is about making sure that we are bettering our relationships around the world, you know, that's focusing on Medicare for all. There are so many of them, John, you know, some of them inspirational and people that we need in Congress and that we need in the Senate, that we need in state legislators, that we need in city councils across the country. So that's where I'm focusing my effort. I'm still excited about the 2020 election because there are so many wonderful people running for office. There's a Nabila Islam in Georgia. There's Ihsan Laki running in Massachusetts. I mean, there are people, there's Charles Booker. There's like so many wonderful people that are running. And there's also people we need to keep in office, like the Rashidas of the world, the Ilhans of the world, the AOCs of the world. So that's where I'm focusing. And as to go to the presidential, because I know people will think I'm like, it's a cop out that I'm not answering that question. I'm saying to people this, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I think people are capable of making the right decisions. The decision that I'm going to make in this 2020 election is I'm a New Yorker. So in New York, as you know, we're not a swing state. So I can really vote for whoever I feel like it. I can even write Bernie Sanders in. It's just not going to make a difference in a presidential general election as a New Yorker. But if you're in a swing state and your vote does matter in this election, I'm asking you to look at someone like Biden, not as a candidate that aligns with your values and principles per se, not as someone that you're excited about voting for, but look at him as your opponent in the White House. Look at him as someone that come January 2021, we're going to be ready to go all out with organizing, mobilizing, and making sure that Joe Biden is being held accountable to our communities. The reason I say that, John, is because this current administration is not an administration that is our opponent. We can't fight them. We can't move them anywhere. They are pretty solid on where their positions are. And every single day, as you know, they target our community. They're separating families. They are threatening countries to war. They are stripping people of health care. They have been inept in this pandemic. People have literally died at the hands of the, you know, callousness of this administration. So for me, if you live in a swing state, you know, I hope that you believe that the right thing to do is to make Joe Biden our opponent in the White House so we can continue our movement work.
You know, that is very interesting, thinking of it as choosing who your opponent will be. Because often that choice is often presented as, are you going to endorse this person? Are you going to pick them up as a replacement for whoever you were supporting before? And it doesn't have to, of course, be thought of in that way. So that is very interesting. And I totally agree. There, like, even in the first term, obviously, Trump could not be pushed on any issue. And that was when, hypothetically, there were potential consequences for his actions. He's stripped away all of those. There's not going to be any inspectors general going into a second term and all of that. So great, that's a great point. I also want to mention, you mentioned Nabila Islam. We saw news earlier today that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had endorsed her campaign. She's a candidate we've had on multiple times on the show. And I agree, putting your attention into the down ballot races, like, of the little bit of hope and inspiration, the positivity in politics over the past few years that I've had, almost all of it has been driven by a few names. And you named some of them, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and AOC and all of that. The idea that we could potentially have two more or five more or 15 more individuals like that seems like, at this point, a best case scenario for the movement going forward. I certainly could look forward to that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why everyone's like, how are you still excited about this election? I'm like, listen, there are young women, Black people, members of marginalized communities. There are Muslims. There are former refugees. There are amazing, inspirational people that come from the very directly impacted communities that we claim to support. So why don't you, if you were a Bernie Sanders supporter, just pivot. Find one of those local folks that were running on a Bernie Sanders platform. Put your money on them. Make calls for them, text for them. And that's what I'm doing, because I think that that is the way to true democracy, is all politics is local. We cannot wake up every 4 years, John, and remind people that there's an election. There's an election every year, a local election every year. And that's the kind of power that we need to build on a local level. And eventually it will trickle up, not trickle down. It will trickle up to that presidency.
You know, this will probably have to be my final question, but I'm curious. Let's say that we end up with Biden as our opponent in the White House. Are there issue areas where you feel like he could be successfully pressured on, that he wouldn't just, you know, say something that sounds good, but then continue the policies of past administrations? What issue areas give you a little bit of hope?
I think there are three issue areas where I think Biden could be pushed if we build the political will and the movements, and so that we don't go back to bed like we did after Obama got elected. Everyone was like, wow, so amazing. We made history. And all of a sudden, our movements went dormant. And that was the problem. It wasn't Obama's fault. I don't blame Obama. I blame us and our movements. And for Biden, I think it's going to be healthcare, criminal justice reform, and immigration. I think those three particular areas are areas where I truly believe in my heart. If we are consistent, if we are persistent, if we're building power, we're mobilizing, we could truly push him into a transformative place. And even honestly, if we're able to build the power around Congress and members of Congress, we may be eventually able to do Medicare for all. I think that it's not true that he said earlier on that if he got a bill to his desk, that he would veto it. I think that he doesn't believe we can bring a bill to his desk. And I truly believe we can if we focus our efforts there.
I certainly hope that you're right on all those issues, but perhaps that one even more so. If it were to land on his desk, the idea that he would veto it seems incomprehensible, so I certainly hope that you're right. The book is We Are Not Here to Be Bystanders. Linda, there you go. It's been a long time coming. You know, thrilled to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Thanks to the ongoing pandemic, some forms of traditional activism and organizing have become significantly more difficult. But innovative minds are finding ways to deal with the current situation and opening up new opportunities to figure out how you can push the country in the right direction. And we have someone joining us right now to talk about one such effort. Gabe Tobias is the co-founder and national training director for the Movement School and also a senior advisor to the Justice Democrats. Gabe, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, John. Great to be back here.
Glad to have you here. We've talked about the Movement School before. Now you have an online campus program. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in this time of COVID-19, obviously, you can't really do anything in person. In a way, this is not a huge adjustment for us because we've been doing online trainings for the last year or so. We recognize going into this cycle, everything that's happening right now around campaign life, people trying to figure out how do we talk to voters, how do we organize our campaigns, how do we raise money, how do we talk about the big issues that are happening right now in our country. There's a need for campaigns at all levels, you know, from statewide races, congressional races, down to local races, to really learn best practices, to glean some of that work that we had, particularly in the Bernie Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren campaigns, and take some of that knowledge, those best practices, and apply them to their work. So we've launched this large campus program with 6-week intensive courses for any progressive electoral organizers in the country. We've got around 500 actually so far registered for those courses. Wow. So yeah, excited to get all these started and take some of our best practices and put them to use in these couple months when campaigns desperately need to adapt to the new reality of this this crisis moment in the country.
Yeah. Yeah, well, part of the new reality is that when my dog shakes, you can hear it on the mic now because he's here. I'm glad that you've adapted as quickly as you have. I've been very worried over the past couple of months that a lot of like new people running for office for the first time, it's already difficult for a number of different reasons, that this might make it even more difficult, an inability to do sort of some of the canvassing and things like that. I know you want people to sign up for the program there, they'll learn everything. What are some of the big ideas that you're hoping to spread to give both organizers, both those running and those trying to, you know, work outside of direct electoral contests to make sure that they can still be effective?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, John. I think the really challenging thing from a progressive standpoint is we are used to the real energy and momentum being a person-to-person activity for our campaigns, right? We're used to the door knocking, people going out and knocking on doors, talking to voters, getting them mobilized. We're used to the big barnstorm, big, you know, rally events. You think about the Bernie Sanders rallies of 2016 or 2020. Think of AOC rallies in similar ways, right? Get these moments where you get all these people in a room together. And we've depended on that as a source of our energy. We obviously have a lot of really enthusiastic people, volunteers and supporters of all types and different levels of campaigns. And right now, what they have to do is figure out how to take that energy, that people power that we've seen so effective in the past, and translate it to a moment where it's both needed more than ever. We have this crisis moment in the country where these campaigns have to respond and talk about what their bigger vision is, right? How are they... Yeah. How are we imagining, you know, a Congress in the future or governments at state or local levels that are responding to this crisis and doing it in ways that are far better than obviously what Trump has and even what, you know, some leadership in the Democratic Party has been putting forward? What does that big vision look like? That is mobilizing, but we have to find ways to translate some of that into the realities of campaign world where right now you have a lot of elections that are entirely vote by mail, right? So how do you go from an election that you expected people to all turn out on one day or at least a couple of days beforehand to having to go through an absentee ballot application process where you're going online, you're filling out forms, you're waiting for a ballot to come to you, you're filling out the ballot, sending it back. That's a lot more steps for someone to jump through. So a lot of the work is campaigns figuring out how to tap into the big picture vision of the current moment and then translating that into reality of turning out votes for their elections, whether it's primary or looking forward to November in the general election.
You know, for some people who might have been either already involved or looking to get involved in organizing in this particular election, it seems like had the primary gone differently, a not insignificant share of that organizing would be around the presidential contest if Bernie Sanders had been the nominee. It seems, I mean, I could be wrong. It seems like there's going to be less of a focus on that with the way that the direction of the primary went. I don't know to what extent you know about the people who are hoping to learn from you what they specifically want to do with that training, but I'm curious, is some of that energy now being routed to lower level contests, congressional runs and local elections and things like that? Is it more issue specific advocacy? What does it look like the energy is flowing towards right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that seems like it's been maybe a bit of a misconception in the progressive movement in the last month or 2 months since you had sort of slow end of the Bernie Sanders campaign. This idea that was sort of taking the air out of the progressive movement. I think that really hasn't borne out. You know, the people, the saying was always not me, us, right? Mm-hmm. And the us, I think, applied to a lot of this other work that's happening. So what we've seen is all these volunteers and staffers of Sanders' campaign going and shifting down to down ballot races, even for our one of our courses where that's being run in the Movement School campus is being led by three of the people who led Bernie Sanders' campaign, and that's Becca Rast, Jung Cho, and Hannah Furtick, amazing organizers, mm-hmm. led his organizing behemoth, and they're taking that now and helping other campaigns adapt through some of the courses that we're running, and that to me has seemed like the big picture that we, you know, in Movement School are trying to tap into, this idea of the progressive infrastructure that we are building around our world. And I have conversations where people hearken back to the conservative movement in the 60s, right? You had Barry Goldwater in 1964, lost, got mm-hmm. blown out. Could have been a moment where you say, oh, well, you know, Goldwater lost, we're going to go away. But instead, obviously abhorrent people, with abhorrent ideas, but they had a desire to buckle down and really build a movement from that moment. And I think in similar ways, you know, the impact of that in the 60s and 70s and 80s was this massive shift in politics, you know, in the United States, sort of, you know, conservative neoliberal ideas taking hold. And we want to do the same thing in the opposite direction now. And I think that this moment is one where we see the seedlings of that movement coming together across different organizations, across issue organizing and electoral organizing, as you said. And that's exciting. That's exciting to see that take hold, that it isn't just based on, oh, we need this one candidate to drive everything forward. We actually do have this broad-based infrastructure to move change forward, whether it's congressional races, local races, issue fights. I think that is there, and that, like, the more we walk that path, the more we see how that strength lies within the broader movement.
And so for this particular effort, the online campus, are you mainly hoping to bring in people who are, you know, engaged with politics and all that, but might not have done much organizing already? They're looking to get into it. Or is this seeking to take people who have some experience organizing and activism and sort of professionalize them? Who's the target demographic here?
Yeah, it's definitely more the latter for these courses. There's plenty of other things which are meant for early organizers and people who are just learning the craft. These ones here that we have are really meant for folks who are either on campaigns right now, so they have a role on a campaign at some level. They were maybe on a campaign earlier this cycle. Maybe they were Bernie Sanders staff or Warren staff earlier in the cycle, or people who work at grassroots organizations in different places that have some electoral work to their portfolio. They're involved in issue organizing or community organizing, and also involved in campaigns in one way or the other in this cycle. So it's meant for folks who definitely have some experience and are looking to skill up and adapt to the current moment.
Awesome. So definitely something that, if you fit that demographic, it's something you should definitely be thinking about. And for other people who might be watching this video, I know that there's been a lot of reason, both just in a general sense, to be a little bit depressed and a little bit down, but in a political sense, possibly, and Gabe, you alluded to that. But it is good to know that there are organizations like the Movement School out there trying to assemble an army of people who are going to push things in the right direction, give us a little bit of hopes for the future. So, Gabe, I really do appreciate that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Come join our army. Our army is great. We're building it. Yeah.
Thank you. Gabe Tobias of the Movement School, also senior advisor to the Justice Democrats. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, John. Great to be here.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.